Welcome to the Free to Choose Media Podcast. Today's podcast is titled Ayn Rand and Objectivism, Is Atlas Shrugging? Recorded in 1998, Dennis McQuestion, former clinical professor of corporate governance and executive director of the Institute for Excellence in Corporate Governance at the University of Texas at Dallas, speaks with philosopher and author Leonard Peikoff about objectivism, Ayn Rand, and her novel Atlas Shrugged. We hope you enjoy today's episode, and don't forget to subscribe to the Free to Choose Media Podcast.
According to a survey in Parade magazine, Ayn Rand's most famous novel, Atlas Shrugged, is the second most influential book ever written, ranking below only the Bible. Her other major novel, The Fountainhead, was written 55 years ago, and yet it and Atlas Shrugged continue to sell about 100,000 books a year even now, 16 years after Ayn Rand died. But just who was Ayn Rand, and why did she write these and other works? Her philosophy is called objectivism, in which she argues that selfishness is a virtue. But what does that mean as we prepare for the 21st century? Today we have a special treat. One guest, Dr. Leonard Peikoff, Ayn Rand's hand-picked legal and intellectual heir. He's here from his home in California to answer these and other questions. Let's meet him. Please welcome, from California, Leonard Peikoff. Leonard, we're delighted that you're here.
Well, I'm glad to be here. Thanks for having me.
Who was Ayn Rand?
Ayn Rand was a novelist, a philosopher, arch-champion of reason. Her famous novels are Atlas Shrugged and The Fountainhead. And her philosophy is a defense of reason and individualism.
You met her when you were just a kid, so to speak.
17.
Tell us how that happened.
Through a mutual friend. I was a teenager. I was in pre-med. I was visiting California, and I wangled an invitation to her home, and I asked her a couple of philosophic questions, and she gave me overwhelming answers, completely blew me away. Everyone I had ever met before her thought that philosophy was a matter of opinion, and there were no answers, and she gave straightforward, detailed, 20-minute-long answers that not only answered the question, but that finished with the mistakes I had made in my thinking that caused me to ask it and not to know the answer myself. I was on the floor at the end of that.
There are a lot of people, and a lot of us have read the books about her, and even though I never met her, a lot of people who would say that while she was brilliant, I don't think anybody would deny that, would say that it was sometimes difficult, maybe intimidating. Did you find that to be the case?
I never found her intimidating. She had a definite, quick, intense temper. And if she thought that you were doing deliberately something irrational or engaging in some form of sloppy thinking when you could have done better, she would be quick to be indignant, to put it mildly. But if you could show her the reason behind your question or the thing that you didn't know that she didn't realize that you didn't know, she calmed down right away. So I never had a problem with that. I knew there was going to be an explosion, but I knew I could cope with it.
I'm glad you could. And I'd just like to, not to have one in this program, if that's all right with you. Leonard, she is someone who, even the people who have read her novels, a lot of people pronounce her name Ayn Rand, which is what we find all the time.
Ayn rhymes with mine. That's what she used to say.
That wasn't her real name. Tell us something about her background, how she got here, what her real name was.
Her real name, God, was Alicia Rosenbaum. Is that right? Yeah, Alicia Rosenbaum. I've only known her as Ayn Rand. She was born in Russia in 1905. She went through school and high school, college there, and escaped at 21 to the United States. Completely poverty-stricken. She didn't know the language very well, and she went to Hollywood with the idea of writing in silent films and happened by sheer accident to bump into Cecil B. DeMille, and he employed her first in the movie The King of Kings, the silent movie. By the way, on the set of that movie, while she had just come to this country, she found the man that she was in love with, and she tripped him in one of the takes in order to get to meet him, because she couldn't think of any way, you know, to get him to talk to her. And they started dating. Subsequently, she worked as a screenwriter for DeMille, and she married Frank O'Connor.
Why did she write these kinds of novels, and what caused her, what drove her? Do you know that?
Well, what drove her was she decided at the age of 9 to become a writer, a novelist, because she said she did not like the world the way it was. She wanted the world as it could be and should be, and that was her view of art. So she started writing stories from the age of 9, but childlike stories. At the same time, she was developing a philosophy. And she saw the two as being related to each other, because you couldn't present the ideal man until you could define what he was. And the purpose of philosophy was to define the ideal man. So the two grew up together.
Right.
Her early stories and her first philosophy, both before she was 13.
Well, we think sometimes of people who decide early on what they're going to do in life. It sometimes works out, sometimes doesn't. But for someone to come from Russia to America, not knowing the language, and then to be able to write those kinds of novels, and for those of you who haven't seen them, they're about this thick, with the perfection in language that she used, must have taken an incredible amount of discipline.
Oh, incredible, and a tremendous amount of practice. She started off writing short stories in broken English and writing scenarios for the silent screen. And she didn't sell anything until she felt she was competent in English. And it was really, she arrived here in 26, and it wasn't until The Fountainhead, which was close to 20 years later, that she felt she completely mastered English.
A lot of people, myself included, read The Fountainhead in college. And there was even a book written, it usually starts with Ayn Rand. And people read this, they get very, let's say, caught up in the story. I think when people write about philosophy, sometimes we think it's dry, it's difficult. But she wrote it as a novel, as she did with Atlas Shrugged. Why did she choose that form?
Because she wanted ideas in the lives of people where they belong. She did not want them as floating generalities. She wanted stories about actual people showing concretely what different ideas did in their lives. And then at the end, she usually had an abstract summation, like Rourke's speech or Galt's speech, in which you gave the general meaning of the events that you'd seen concretely in advance. So she didn't want meaningless fiction or empty philosophy. She wanted philosophy applied to concrete lives.
You have a radio show in Los Angeles, syndicated in several markets around the country. And the show's title is what?
Philosophy, Who Needs It?
So
it's a belligerent
title, it is.
In the sense that I get asked that question all the time. So I figured I'd make that the title of the show and then show them why people need philosophy.
Why do people need philosophy?
Because they're alive, they're human, they have a rational faculty, they can't escape it. You can escape astrophysics and never have a thought on it in your entire life. You cannot escape philosophy, because implicitly, or if not explicitly, you have some kind of values, some idea of what you're after, what's good or bad, what's desirable or undesirable. That's ethics. And you have some idea of what you will take as reliable knowledge, what counts as true and what is just nonsense or absurd. And that's epistemology. That's a branch of philosophy which tells you how to acquire reliable knowledge. So those two branches, which are the key of, to philosophy, you can't avoid. You can either have unconscious, mixed up, contradictory ideas, or consistent, explicit ones. That's it.
She said some things, and we have a graphic on our screen right now about philosophy, and I can see it from here, and I'll read it to the audience. As a human being, you have no choice about the fact that you need a philosophy. Your only choice is whether you define your philosophy by a conscious, rational, disciplined process of thought and scrupulously logical deliberation, or let your subconscious accumulate a junk heap of unwarranted conclusions, false generalizations, undefined contradictions, undigested slogans, and unidentified doubts and fears. Obviously, she didn't have a strong opinion about it, as you can tell.
She never held strong opinions. Very tentative about everything.
Exactly. But when she put this philosophy together, she didn't have, I don't even know if she went to college, did she?
Yes,
she went to college.
Bachelor's degree in Russia.
In Russia. In journalism or?
No, she majored in history.
In history, okay.
Because she said there was no way to tell people what they ought to do until you first found out what they had done and what the results were.
And I think that's something that a lot of people talk about the future, but I find that a lot of people don't understand where they are now, much less where they've come from. Did she basically say that you had to understand where you came from, where you were, before you understood where you were going?
Yes, she thinks that a knowledge of history was an essential to originate a proper philosophy. Because it's like the laboratory of human actions. We see what choices people made and what the consequences were. You just have to look at the Middle Ages versus the Renaissance or the ancient world, and that tells you what belief in God does in human life, to get in one indication.
Well, now, you just mentioned something that I would imagine is probably the most controversial part of her philosophy. A lot of people who I personally know who've talked about this over the years have said, yeah, I really agree with what Ayn Rand said. I really agree with objectivism, which is what she called her philosophy. However, you know, there's that but and however, she didn't believe in God. And you just mentioned that some of these atrocities that you mentioned in the Middle Ages had to do with faith in some way. Tell us what that controversy is all about.
Well, she didn't believe in God or gremlins or ghosts or Santa Claus or witches or anything supernatural. By definition, the supernatural is that which transcends the realm of physical objects which are interconnected, which make up nature. So they're not accessible to our senses. It's not accessible to our reason because our reason can only draw conclusions from the sensory material that we observe. So therefore, it's something unknowable and in conflict with everything we do know. So her attitude was, either you accept reality as you perceive it and your mind, which is your means of knowing it, or you reject all of reality and your mind for the sake of something unknowable that contradicts them both. And she certainly, in a choice like that, there was no question.
But 90% of the people plus in this country, almost all of which are very nice people, very productive people, many of whom are intellectual, many of whom are scientists, many of whom are super large IQs, believe in the concept of God on some basis. 39% of them go to church, etc. I mean, they have a lot of different ways of defining it, but they believe in something beyond this earth, beyond themselves. How do you explain that?
Well, I'll quote her. She said, it's earlier than you think. Historically speaking, we're still emerging from the medieval period. Each century since the Renaissance has seen a decline in religion, and it's still disappearing, but it's going to take a long, long time. And one of the main reasons that people continue to believe in God, good people, is because they believe that's the only possible source of ethics. And, of course, the intellectuals and the educators today tell them that. They tell them that everything is a matter of opinion. There are no absolutes. There is no morality. That's what's presented as the secular viewpoint. And, therefore, people come to the conclusion that if they believe in morality, and, after all, a human being can't live without a moral code, they have to do it through religion. Religion has had a monopoly on morality, and that is its lifeblood, and that's when Ayn Rand was out to break that tie between religion and ethics.
But how can you have a moral code without appealing to the supernatural?
Well, how can you have it by appealing to the supernatural?
No, I ask you first.
Okay. It's very simple. What is morality? According to Ayn Rand, the standard of morality is man's life. The good is that which promotes human life. And a man has to survive by a certain means. He has a rational faculty. Every living organism has a means of survival, and man's is the mind. So therefore, you have to live by a code of virtues which enable you to use your mind to the full. And she defined what they consist of. Independence, integrity, justice, every one of those is validated as being a form of rationality and essential, therefore, to the full development of the mind, and therefore to self-preservation.
A lot of people, however, have either never been exposed to that or don't believe it. You wrote this book a few years ago called Objectivism, the Philosophy of Ayn Rand, and you wrote about it pretty specifically in here. What would you suggest to that person watching this program who is interested in expanding their mind, not necessarily agreeing with your position, obviously, but how could they best understand where you're coming from so they can either argue against it or agree with it, as the case may be?
Well, I mean, if they want a short presentation, a medium, a long, a fiction, emphasis on ethics, on politics, there's a tremendous amount of literature out there. I wouldn't recommend starting with my book because it's fairly comprehensive and I hope, helpful, but it's a more advanced...
It's not easy to read, is what you're trying to say, and I can tell you that.
It's hard to cover all those.
But it's not your 495 novel, it's not a John Grisham novel,
no,
to say the least.
I wish it sold like that.
but they can start with...
I would say they should start with The Fountainhead. It's a simple story that anyone can read and be interested in, and can grasp something of the ideas, and then they can go on from there.
Okay, thanks.
What is the present status of the teaching of objectivism, and what do you see in the immediate future for objectivism?
You mean the teaching of objectivism in the schools?
No. Among people like this, seminars and universities and so forth.
Well, the Ayn Rand Institute in Los Angeles runs programs, has essay contests and campus clubs throughout high schools and colleges in this country. And there are individual professors at the universities that make various works of Ayn Rand's required. Not nearly enough. Our universities, to answer you directly, in my opinion, are closed to controversy. Only fashionable controversy they allow. But if it's something that is not accepted by their significant others, it's something that challenges what they essentially believe, they are barred to it. It's simply closed. They won't allow it in. As I know, I taught for many years in philosophy departments, and I know what the attitude of colleges is to unpopular ideas.
One of the things that I think you and Ayn Rand and some others talked about over many years was the idea of actually getting more of this taught on the college campuses. In fact, I think at one point in your time, you just said that's the key item. I think you kind of backed off of that. But today, with the Ayn Rand Institute and some other folks do put on seminars, right? You do courses by phone, or how does that work?
Oh, I do phone courses all the time with people around the country and around the world. But there's more advanced courses on objectivism. But there are institutions that specialize in putting together conferences and courses. But that's not Harvard and Yale, unfortunately. Not yet.
Thanks.
Getting back to the religion issue, everybody ascribes reason to whatever their philosophy is. This may not be a direct quote, but if my memory serves me correctly, Ayn said that religion is the antithesis of reason.
Yeah.
How would you answer those who think whatever their philosophy happens to be, whether it's religious or not, has a sense of reason to it?
Well, I'd say we have to say what reason is. If you define reason appropriately, then you can decide what it is or isn't reasonable. Now, I define reason as that which is either based on sensory observation or logical inference therefrom, and which is expressible in conceptual terms. That is to say, it can't be, I have an ineffable grasp of something that I can't put into words. If it can't be put into words, it's out as far as reason is concerned. Mm-hmm. If it can't be supported by evidence, it's out. So
the leap of faith doesn't count.
The leap of faith is the antithesis of reason. Faith is the acceptance in the either in the absence of
the
reason
absence
or in opposition to reason. So Plato, for instance, thinks that the form of the good, which is equivalent of God, is reached by reason. But reason for him is an ineffable grasp in that case of a supernatural entity. So I certainly wouldn't call that reason. Absolutely not.
Thank you. Lance?
I think we can all agree that Ayn Rand's had enormous impact on the political culture, not only of this country, but of the entire world. Socialism is in retreat. I think that the world is a very different place from what it was in the 1960s when I was growing up. But one thing I would like to see, and I'd like to ask you about, is I think that if Atlas Shrugged was turned into a movie, that would do more to disseminate the great ideas of Ayn Rand than anything else I can think of, even more than the movie Ayn Rand, A Sense of Life, which I saw in L.A., and I'd like to see in Dallas as well. But my understanding, if I'm incorrect about this, let me know, is that you have something to do with whether or not this movie is ever to be produced.
Now, Not true.
Okay.
I had something to do with it and watched the movie be turned down by every major Hollywood studio and every television network and most major stars on the grounds that it's simply too controversial. Their agents or their lawyers wouldn't let them come near it. The moguls didn't want to have anything to do with it. And I finally sold the rights outright to someone, and I no longer have any control. A businessman who is trying to do something with it, whether and what he's going to do, I have no idea. I backed out of it because I decided that it was premature. There was not the talent or ability in Hollywood or in the television world to make that book. So,
and a couple of things. I think that perhaps most people here know that The Fountainhead was made into a movie, I think in about 1942 or 44 with Gary Cooper. And it was a black and white movie, an interesting movie, to say the least. And he also mentioned, or maybe it was Phil who mentioned, the movie Ayn Rand, A Sense of Life. And I think, Lance, you said you had seen that. Tell us a bit about that movie. We hope to get some clips, but because of all the releases, we couldn't get them for this program. Tell us just a bit about that movie and what it's all about.
That's a two-hour documentary that was made after her death, basically out of interviews from her friends or her appearances on Mike Wallace, Johnny Carson, and so on. It's a kind of biography using a lot of stills from her estate that I provided. And it was nominated, actually, for an Academy Award, which I just almost, you could have knocked me over with a with less than a feather. It didn't win, but that it got nominated in today's Academy was amazing. It's very instructive, and it's showing now, if anybody is interested in seeing it.
Yeah, it's a very passionate film, too. Yes, sir.
Given that one of the central tenets is that selfishness is a virtue, and the non-belief in supernatural power, given that I read Ayn Rand a long time ago, could you sort of give me a little bit of overview? How do you, what force do you use as a break against rampant selfishness, to hurting other people?
You know? We have to define selfishness. Selfishness is simply holding yourself and your welfare as the top value. It does not say how you should achieve your values or even how to define your welfare. Ayn Rand defines your welfare in terms of your life as a human being and defines virtue as the exercise of reason. So her definition of selfishness is acting to achieve your own welfare by your own mind and effort, neither sacrificing yourself to others nor others to yourself. So there's absolutely a prohibition against sacrifice as such. She rejects the idea, which is common today, that there's only two choices in life. Either you cut your throat for other people, and that's called altruism and self-sacrifice, or you cut their throat for you, and that's called selfishness. She tells us that gives you only a choice of throat cutting, and it's just a haggling over whose blood is going to be shed. The proper human policy should be we're against it. We oppose sacrifice as such. Each man lives as an independent entity, achieving his own goals and trading with others voluntarily when he chooses to. So there's no malignant force that you have to have a break of.
You have on the screen now her definition of altruism. She says it's the basic principle of altruism that man has no right to exist for his own sake, that service to others is the only justification of his existence, and self-sacrifice is his highest moral duty, virtue, and value. She talked about it a lot in all of her books and all the other things that she wrote, and yet does that mean that people don't do things for other people?
Well, you see, this is the point. Altruism is a term coined by Auguste Comte in the 19th century. It means literally otherism. It was a substitute for theology. Just as under religion you were supposed to live for God and everything was for God, he said you should live for others and everything is for others. It was just a placing of humanity in the position of God. But the individual was still a self-sacrificial agent. Now, the fact of doing something for others is not incompatible with egoism if you do it for selfish reasons, if you do it for selfish gain. If it's somebody you love, my wife, for instance, I would certainly throw myself into the water to save her life because my life is richer with hers and I wouldn't want to go on without her. So I would do something to help her, and the same for my daughter or for friends. But I do it on the grounds that they mean something to me and they advance my life. That's not altruism. It's altruism when I help others as a sacrifice. When I jump in the water to save Adolf Hitler, whom I loathe and despise, but what the hell, I shouldn't be selfish and assert my standards. I'm supposed to live for others. He's another. He's not me.
Right. Well, we just had on the screen the definition of egoism, and I won't read it. I think it's been up there long enough for people to see, but define for us the difference between egoism and egotism.
Well, egotism is not a philosophic term. Egotism has been defined as an obnoxious egoist, but I think that's just a joke, and it's a coinage of the other camp, so I don't use the word.
Okay, thanks. Yes, sir.
I'm curious, what impact do you think objectivism has had on the real world? An earlier questioner thought that it had a major impact. I'm not as sanguine about that. I do know that We the Living was made into a movie by Benito Mussolini in 1942.
No, by Mussolini. His regime that was pirated. And he took it out of circulation within about 3 months because people were cheering the movie because they realized it was so anti-fascist. And his people didn't have the brains to realize that. And as soon as they grasped it, he got orders from the Germans under Hitler to get that movie out of the theaters right away.
Well, that's a story I'd heard. I had heard it was supposed to come across as an anti-communist movie, and it actually...
It was an anti-communist story, but it was also anti-fascist.
Right, so it ended up coming across as anti-totalitarian. So
right.
Do you think objectivism played a role in helping roll back totalitarianism, and what impact does it play today in the real world?
I don't know whether it had a role in helping to roll back totalitarianism. It had a role in, to some extent, in some individuals and some leaders not feeling so guilty about standing up for freedom and individual rights, which they used to feel tremendously guilty. And there have been individual leaders around the world that have claimed to be influenced by it. Margaret Thatcher was an obvious example. But I wouldn't go so, I'm not paranoid enough to think that it's had that greater role in the world. I think its main role is going to be in the future, in the generations growing up now who are learning it and going to go into the colleges and teach it.
Thanks. Mr. Peikoff, I come to you as someone who was fortunate enough to have Ayn Rand and some of her works taught to me at the university and required for courses.
What university?
Bowling Green State University. Wow. In philosophy.
Okay. Yeah.
And the course was on rights theory. And one of the things that, since this gentleman has opened up the discussion of her view of government, from the headlines today we hear the Republic of Texas people are being tried. And one of the things that I've read in your book and I read in her works is that we have an obligation to follow rational government, that we should even go as so far as to give up our right of physical force and self-defense, you say except in extreme situations, and let the government take that over, that it's the government's job. My question is, what happens when if we don't have a rational government? And are you obligated to follow laws of a non-rational government? How far do you have to go?
You can't ask me that because it's against the law to advocate breaking the law. So if I did think so, I wouldn't be free to say it. All I can tell you is that if your government is not rational, you have to decide in your own mind, is there still free speech or not? If there's still free speech, you have a chance to fight. And therefore, I say you should fight intellectually, educationally, ideologically. If, however, and at the point when there's censorship, then go underground, revolt, and have another American Revolution. But I think it's too soon to give up this country. I don't think it's time to say it's hopeless. As long as you can have programs like this.
Leonard, the issue of the role of government. She spent a lot of time in her novels and in writing in other ways about what she saw as the appropriate role of government. Tell us what that role is and tell us kind of where you see us now in a spectrum of where we are in terms of the limits that she would place versus where we are today.
She believed with the founding fathers that there are a few inalienable rights: life, liberty, property, and the pursuit of happiness. And that they can be violated only by physical force or the threat or fraud. And that the function of government is to protect us in those rights against force or fraud. And that this meant three essential agencies: the police to protect you against domestic crime, the military against foreign, and the courts to enable us to adjudicate disputes without having to resort to war or to fist fights. Beyond that, she said there should be laissez-faire, hands off. There should be no welfare state. There should be none of the things that Franklin Roosevelt introduced, no antitrust legislation, nothing that has been injected since this country was founded has been a continuous departure from the ideals of the founding fathers. As to where we are now, if you take communism and Nazism as the extreme of the complete collapse of rights, we are somewhere well over halfway from the founding fathers to complete totalitarianism. It's impossible to quantify it. But the common belief among the parties today is not to protect rights, but the simply dispute is which rights to violate. And the liberals want the government to control economics, and the conservatives want government to control morality and spiritual issues, to impose their beliefs by force. And so between the Republicans and the Democrats, it's a fight over who is going to get new laws on faster and which new laws. Between both of them, how long have we got? It's impossible for a philosopher to predict, but the trend is bad. It's getting worse. It has been bad for a long time. And you yourself could know this. If you imagine bringing Jefferson or Madison back and let them look at Washington today, they would drop dead. It would be inconceivable. They talked about a debased posterity, but they could never have dreamt, you know, in their worst nightmares of what is taken for granted today as common sense.
Thanks.
You led right into my question very, very well. You spoke of Democrats and Republicans. Everything that Ayn Rand said was so libertarian. I was a lowercase libertarian until I read Ayn Rand. Many of us came to the Libertarian Party and became capital L libertarians. Can you tell us exactly why she objected to the formation of the party?
Absolutely. Libertarianism is an ad hoc group around the term liberty. And their view is, let's forget about philosophy or definitions. If you are for liberty, regardless of your definition or the philosophy that led you to it or the lack of philosophy that led you to it, we'll unite together. Now, I say that makes liberty a travesty. It makes it an empty term. It's a banner unfurled to attract every crackpot in the world who says he's for liberty. It would be exactly as if I said, let's start a party, the Justicist Party. Whoever is for justice, come to me. I don't care your definition. I don't care your philosophy. Let's promote justice in the world. You'd say, obviously, you can't do that until you tell me what justice is, what you mean by it, why it's good. Otherwise, Adolf Hitler was for justice. He was for Lebensraum, justice to the German people. Liberty is empty. It's meaningless. And what you get there for is a bunch of crackpots, such as anarchists. Not you. You are obviously there under a misapprehension, and there's a lot of there's a lot of people that go into libertarianism thinking that this is really for liberty and then find out differently. But they have anarchists, Ayn Rand used to call them hippies of the right, to cut it short.
Terry. One of the people that followed Ayn Rand's philosophy and was quite well known today is Alan Greenspan, the chairman of the Fed.
Yes.
And I wanted to ask you what you feel, what influence that Ayn Rand had on him, and if we've seen some of that in the policies that he has administered, and if he has parted ways, why he did that.
Oh, I wouldn't want to comment on him personally. I haven't spoken to Alan for many, many years. I do not believe that he's acting in accordance with objectivism, except insofar as he works to keep inflation down. But his behavior on the Social Security Commission and on several other things, in my opinion, puts him totally at odds with objectivism. As to why he's doing it, you phone the Federal Reserve and ask them.
I'm trying to figure out who influenced who, if either. Hayek talked about enlightened self-interest. How does that word enlightened fit in to the selfishness concept? Doesn't that require a certain degree of enlightenment on the part of the population before this concept of selfishness can flourish?
Well, that's not Ayn Rand's term, enlightened.
No, it's
self-interest. Hayek's. She believes in rational self-interest. Enlightened self-interest goes back, I believe, to the 18th century, and the idea was that your enlightenment consists of not being completely selfish, but in incorporating other people's welfare into your own. So it was a hodgepodge, a mixture of altruism. The whole 18th century in that regard, morally speaking, was a compromise between egoism and service to others. They were trying to combine Greek and Christian ethics. And enlightened self-interest wasn't one of the forms of that compromise. But she doesn't compromise. She goes back in that regard to Aristotle, who was a pure, naked egoist. He believed that you live for your own happiness and you achieve it by developing your own potentiality.
How did Ayn Rand's philosophy express itself in politics, or did she?
Well, I just said, you mean the function of government, or do you mean practical politics?
How did she practice, what kind of politics did she...
Well, she voted for the lesser of two evils when she voted. Do you mean that?
Was she involved in the political process?
In her early years in this country, she thought that she could get together a group of people, on the right and do something. And it was a series of bitter disillusionments to her to find out how mealy-mouthed, how compromising, and how inept they were. And she finally renounced practical politics altogether on the ground that it's just too soon. You can't have a political revolution before you have an intellectual one. And that's what she devoted herself to.
Well, along that line, one of the things that she talked about, the thing that you mentioned, that her theory of politics, so to speak, is a social system known as capitalism. Tell us what capitalism is. I think we have a graphic that talks about capitalism. So if I can get the right one up here, we'll look at capitalism in just a second. And I think that is graphic number 8. Let's look at what capitalism, what she said about it, and then tell us in your own words how capitalism is the ideal, so to speak. Here's what she says. The moral justification of capitalism does not lie in the altruist claim that it represents the best way to achieve the common good. The moral justification of capitalism lies in the fact that it is the only system consonant with man's rational nature, that it protects man's survival qua man, and that its ruling principle is justice. Tell us what she meant by, is she strictly a laissez-faire capitalist pig? Is that basically the situation?
She is a complete, well, pig is your evaluation. But she is complete laissez-faire, unregulated, uncontrolled, which is not anarchy. It's the way this country was founded. It's government as a protector of individual rights, as I've earlier defined, but no economic role. Capitalism is a separation of state and economics, just in the same way and for the same reasons as we have the separation of state and religion. As long as no physical crime is committed, no fraud is committed, everything is up to the voluntary transactions of the individuals involved. You succeed by producing a better product and outdoing your competitors. You fail if you can't. So each man is on his own. His motive should be profit. That is a selfish motive, which he achieves by production, not by government favors. What we have today is not capitalism. What we have is a mixed economy, which has some capitalists, some fascists, some communists, and some, you know, distinctively eclectic, undefinable elements, all of it mashed together and pushed by pressure groups. Today people think that capitalism is favors to businessmen. That's some Republicans' definition, but that is not capitalism. That is no more capitalism than favors to any group is capitalism. Capitalism means hands off. It means unrestricted dog-eat-dog, each individual for his own profit, committing no crimes. A crime defined as force or fraud.
Okay, yeah. You would agree that with most people, economists who would say that that sort of an approach, it's, let's just call it the Adam Smith invisible hand, that each person working in their own self-interest would, as if by an invisible hand, improve the lot of everybody. But I think where you would disagree is that that would be the reason for it. Is that right?
Absolutely. Oh, thank you for saying that. As I say, I have to say that all the time. Of course, capitalism advances the public good, but that is not its justification. Otherwise, the implication would be the purpose of each of us in this life is to serve the public. And here's a system that serves the public, therefore it's good. We don't believe that our purpose in life is to serve others. And therefore, it's a secondary consequence. Obviously, if you leave each individual free to pursue his own happiness and then stand back, the group as a whole is going to be much, much better off. So it's, you can't avoid that, but it's not that you're leaving each man free because you're more interested in the group as a group. Groups as a group are a collective, and that's a myth. It's just a summation of individuals.
I'm going to go to this question here, then we're going to talk about collectivism and what she said about that.
Okay. You mentioned the original Constitution and that Ayn Rand would have been a supporter of that.
Yes. With some exceptions,
The dominant intellectual influence on the founders was John Locke and the social contract.
Right.
I'm curious if you think Ayn Rand is an advocate of the social contract, and if not, or if so, what are the intellectual errors that she has? You mentioned Aristotle. Are there any other people that we can cite?
Well, Aristotle is her main favorite in the history of philosophy. Thomas Aquinas, to the extent that he reintroduced Aristotle, minus his Catholicism, but he was a great philosopher. If you ever read Summa Theologica, it was a brilliant mind, and he really understood Aristotle. And John Locke, to the extent that he carried that same thing forward, because there was a strong Aristotelian element in Locke in his advocacy of rights. Unfortunately, Locke is a hodgepodge of Augustine and Descartes and many other things in addition, so he's a very weak read. But insofar as he advocated individual rights, he was directly responsible for this country.
Surely.
You mentioned earlier that we've come a long way from the founders, and I think that's evident to everyone, where you say over 50% towards fascism, totalitarianism of some type. And the question is, you mentioned in your book that we need a vigilant population, our founders believe this as well, to maintain the institutions that foster liberty. My question is, how do you think we can go forward to history in a sense?
Oh, I think we can. I think we will. But I'd have to say ultimately. And ultimately can be a very long time. It depends on education. It depends upon people being taught the right ideas. I think the majority of people in this country are reasonable people in this country. They still are experiencing the American legacy. There's a tremendous breach between the intellectuals, the university professors, and the public. If you could infiltrate the universities, if they would have one pro-capitalist, pro-reason professor for every 100 socialists and irrationalists, I think the country would be safe. We would have nothing to worry about. So that, to me, is the practical problem, to break the monopoly of the universities on accepting only one viewpoint. You know, they have all kinds of controversies within the dogma. You can have 10 kinds of irrationalism and 10 kinds of socialism, but you can't get outside those categories. And that's what has to be done. And practically speaking, there's various possible ways, one of which would be to convince big business to stop financing these people, because that is truly altruism. That is truly giving the money to your own killers.
The thing that some people have said, that the only Marxists, Leninists left in the world are professors, tenured professors on college campuses in America.
In
yes.
America, yeah.
I want to talk about this concept of collectivism. We have graphic number 9. I want to read that. And then I want you to tell us about what she meant by collectivism. And then this idea of whether communism and fascism are, some people see it as a fascism as a far right and a communism as a far left, and try to tie that together. So if we could look at that graphic right now. It says here, according to her, that fascism and communism are not two opposites, but are two rival gangs fighting over the same territory. Both are variants of statism based on the collectivist principle that man is the rightless slave of the state. Exactly what did she mean by that?
Well, collectivism is the exaltation of the group above the individual, and then of the state as the representative of the group having absolute authority to do what it wishes to the individual. Collectivist systems differ only according to how they define the supreme group. So communism and Nazism differ in that communism uses economic criteria and Nazi uses racial criteria. One says the proletariat, the dispossessed, is the supreme group, and the other says, no, the racial elite, the Aryans. But there's no difference between them as systems, except which particular collective is devouring the individual, but that the individual should be devoured, that it's the function of the state to enslave him totally in the name of service to the group, is identical in the two systems.
Dr. Peacock, you've seen that in today's environment, one of the major forces that's influencing our world is the internet and technology. And you knew Ms. Rand very well, probably better than anyone. If she were alive today, what do you think would be her opinion of the internet, the World Wide Web, the news groups, and what do you think she would tell us today?
How could anybody have a negative opinion of the internet? The internet is a magnificent disseminator, sometimes of misinformation, but it's the potential of disseminating information and of freeing us from dependence on, you know, a small cabal of people, of newspaper owners or whatever. It's a fantastic discovery, and the great thing about the internet is the government does not yet know how to regulate it. They're trying to get their foot in the door, but the internet so far has been very vocal, the people connected with it, in denouncing the attempt, and as long as they hold out, that's a major bastion of freedom.
There, while you were talking, they flashed your website address, so you'll probably be hearing from some people, so be ready
okay,
for it.
Great.
What the heck? Let me shift in just the 10 minutes that we have left to a couple of things. First, about the novel Atlas Shrugged. And I had shown you this earlier something that we found in Colorado, which is an appropriate state before. First, on the front of this thing, it says John Galt Veil. And on the back of it, it says, we can get a shot of this, if I can hold it up here. Who is John Galt? Tell us, and for that viewer who probably hasn't read Atlas Shrugged, what does this phrase mean? What did it have to do with the story?
You don't want me to answer it, though. Because that's the mystery of the novel.
So. No, not, I don't want the whole answer, right, but just give us enough that we
who
know
who is John Galt is the opening line of the book, and it is something that is said by all the different characters in moods of futility and despair and hopelessness. So it conveys somehow something has happened to the world, something has gone wrong, we can't cope anymore, what's the use, who is John Galt? And then the story is to find out who is John Galt and what did he, or I don't want to give away, what did it have to do with the state of the world? What caused the collapse of the world and can it be rebuilt?
It's a story about a strike as well.
Well,
and in your instance, it's a story about a strike when a certain group of people who've never gone on strike before actually go on strike. Tell us just a bit about that, again, without giving away the story.
Well, once you say the strike. She was going to call it the strike,
right.
And she was persuaded not to on the grounds that would give away the plot, but now we've done it, so it's a it's a strike of the men of the mind. She said, every other kind of people have gone on strike and said, now we demand so-and-so, or you can't have what we have to offer. She said, this is the first strike of the thinkers, who are actually the producers, the intellectuals, in the valid sense of the term, who make the world go round and who have always been cursed as being selfish or intransigent or materialistic or commercial or whatever. And this is the time when they stop and they say, if you want what we have to offer, you have got to do it on our terms. And they vanish. And you see what happens to the world when it has every single thing that it has today. It has every Washington politician. It has every professor. It has everything it's got, except it does not have the great producers or the great thinkers in any field. And then you see what happens.
Well, she wrote this novel roughly between 1945 and 1957. And
right.
The people would say that she was an incredible predictor of the future, but I'm not sure that's why she wrote it, is it?
Oh, no. She wrote it because she saw the principle. She saw it happening here in the 30s. She was very disillusioned when she came to this country, because she found that the intellectuals in the 30s were saying the very things that she had run from in Soviet Russia. She was astounded. She couldn't believe it. For 5 to 10 years after she arrived here, she kept asking herself, it must be that she's getting a misinterpretation of the country, that it is so far left that she could have been in Soviet Russia. And then she started the war against these intellectuals, and they retaliated by declaring war on her from all sides, right and left. The left, of course, hated her because she was anti-capitalist, and the right because she was anti-religious, and the middle because she was an absolutist. So, you know, the entire spectrum turned on her, but I think she was equal to it because she turned on them.
I'm going to get another comment here from him, but first, he has something on his lapel here, and it's something that I have worn for one reason because of this, but also because I'm a former banker. If we can get a shot, maybe get a shot of mine, and it looks a lot like his just happens to be bigger, which means he has more money. But I tell people on the one on my lapel, this was an 8-foot by 8-foot dollar sign. This is after taxes and regulations, so that's what I point out. Tell us about the dollar sign, why it was important to her.
Well, the dollar sign was a symbol to her of free trade and therefore of free minds. It was a symbol of freedom. And originally, you know, the dollar sign was the monogram of the U.S. It's the U.S., and she said that if you want to know the fate of the United States, ask yourself what the chances are of a country that uses its own monogram as a symbol of depravity. And you know that in every cartoon where there's a corrupt figure, he's got a dollar sign and pig eyes. And that's the state that we've come to in the United States.
I just wanted to say, I guess my view is a little bit more optimistic towards the future in the current state of, you know, if you want to assess where we are in the world today, with individualism versus collectivism. I mean, we have seen the fall of the Berlin Wall, the total collapse of the Soviet Union. I see market forces fervent and alive, and I see Central Europe coming around and becoming more capitalist and more free. Freedom of speech has been restored. I see a great cause of optimism, and I also attribute that to Ayn Rand's philosophy and having a subtle indirect influence which is permeating throughout the entire world culture. Can you comment on that?
Yes, I would agree with you. It's certainly a good thing that the Cold War is over and that Russia collapsed. There is a much more international capitalism than there was. The problem is the battle has been won, but the American leadership does not know it and is giving away the store in the process. So they're going to get us right back to the same position again. They built up Russia by trade and lend-lease and every kind of favor. Russia collapsed despite it by virtue of the inefficacy of communism. Now Clinton and his friends are repeating the same thing with Red China. I think if Clinton were to be impeached, it shouldn't be because of who he slept with or played with in the White House. It should be because he allowed Hong Kong to be taken over by Red China. That is such a traitorous action, to allow the one bastion of freedom over there, the greatest bastion of freedom, to be taken over by this corrupt, vicious country, and to turn the other cheek and say, yes, it's fine with us, when he is the only superpower left in the world. He wouldn't even have had to go to war. He would just simply have had to say, keep your nose out of Hong Kong, and we mean it. But of course, no one believes the United States in foreign policy, because the United States is a total wimp in foreign policy. So that even this creature in Iraq will thumb his nose at us. It's a disgrace to have a country with this weak a foreign policy that is as strong militarily, and it's because it's undercut morally, because the leadership has no confidence in the principles on which this country was founded. They spend their entire time apologizing for it and in global altruism, trying to serve. And the worse the nation, according to altruism, the more noble you are to serve it. So they're loving their enemies and killing us in the process.
There was an interesting column by George Will a couple of days ago when he went forward 3 or 4 years and the president was down in Antarctica apologizing in Antarctica because we hadn't done much for them lately, that we've been apologizing for everything. It's obvious to me, and we just have a couple minutes left, that you and your philosophy and she and her philosophy don't apologize for much. Are you just that confident of your... I mean, it's rare to find someone whose opinions are just, it seems to me, this black and white, and this is the way it is, take me as I am.
Well, do you apologize for the fact that 2 and 2 is 4 and that you know it, you can prove it, and if no matter how big the gang that says it's 5, it doesn't shake you up?
Well, some people loved Ayn Rand. Some people hated her because of some of these things, didn't they?
Oh, yes. Great many, especially institutional pressure groups, hated her because it was the end of feeding at the trough. It was the end of the big business that were getting all their special favors. It was the end of the unions that were decreed by law. It was the end of religions. If not, they could be voluntary, but if people listened to her ideas, it was the end of liberals and conservatives and moderates. I mean, there's a lot of special interests that were tremendously threatened by her, absolutely.
Looking forward, the rest of your life, you're still a relatively young man, or at least the makeup's pretty darn good.
It's the makeup.
What do you think you can do with your radio show, with the writings that you do? What are you trying to accomplish?
I'm trying to reach a small number of individuals who have the honesty and the intelligence and the interest in philosophy to devote their lives to spreading those ideas, to become an educational, philosophic force to change the thinking of this country. I don't expect to see more than a dozen individuals in the time that I have remained that would become accomplished teachers and intellectuals, you know, 10, 20, you can't predict exactly, and then leave it to them and hope. I mean, where there's life, there's hope. Sometimes it looks black, but I still think that this is America, and that however bad it gets, there is something of the original American feeling for life left in people, that you can't get it brainwashed out of them totally, and that's the only thing to count on.
We appreciate your sense of life, and as Leonard said during the program, those who knew Ayn Rand typically loved her or hated her. Now, I've seen the movie of her life. It was nominated, as he said, for an Academy Award, and it's entitled Ayn Rand, A Sense of Life. and I recommend it to you. But no matter what you think about her ideas, if you read and study them, they will do one thing if no other. And that one thing is the ultimate goal of education. They will force you to think. Our goal on this program is now what it has always been, to provide you with an objective, no pun intended, source of information that encourages you to think. Not just about the headlines that come racing across the TV set every day, but rather about what is behind the events, the philosophies that determine ideas, policies. On our next program, we'll examine some of those events and compare the philosophies of a liberal, a conservative, and yes, an objectivist. Join us then, when as always, we'll talk about things that matter with people who care.
Want more episodes like this? Don't forget to subscribe and get updates each week for the Free to Choose Media Podcast.